welcome to another ABC Radio National podcast. For more information, go to abc.net.au/rn.
Travelling to no deadline and with no fixed route, I'm on my way to live in Adelaide. As my first cautious weeks go by, I recognise the way described with such a mixture of comedy and pathos in Farhad Uddinata's 12th century mystical classic, Mantek Otter, or The Conference of the Birds. Even in the doggerel of the English translation, I feel an enchantment which is also connected to the beauty of my battered old Penguin paperback. The Persian miniature on the cover depicts a multitude of birds gathered by a decorative river. With as plucky a spirit as they can muster, they too are leaving the safety of their homes. Only with the assistance of each other, Attar's spiritual allegory emphasises, will the birds find their way. His riddling tales often mock the solitary attempts of desert Sufis, wrapped up in dangerous self-importance. Unless, warns Attar, you can see divinity everywhere and in everything, including every human being, then you're missing out on the mystery of the world. For the first 6 months, though, once I've ascertained that even with MS the camping life is possible for me, I hide out alone in the state forests of northeastern New South Wales. In the bush I take respite from the inundation of people that occurs after you have almost died. Old trees and rain, starry skies and insects, these are the antidotes I crave. Frogs croaking, the songs of crickets, spider webs strung between fronds of lamandras. This is when my true recovery begins. Moonlight can bring the impression that a galaxy of stars, a miniature Milky Way, is sliding into the tree closest to my camp. One morning before light, my water bucket holds a reflection of the waning crescent moon at such a steep angle that the song of the first shrike thrush of morning seems to touch its tip. To think that it was only due to catastrophe that I've chosen this way to live. In order to avoid another medical emergency, my van is rigged for safety, not only with a two-way radio, but also an EPIRB device that, if activated when I'm out of mobile phone range, instantly alerts an emergency centre and via satellite locates my exact position. Life in these forest camps is calm and kind, my water dipper going in and out of reed-rimmed wetland. Because I don't set up in well-known, overused beauty spots, all is fresh, the energy untrammelled, and not a vodka cruiser can or chewing gum wrapper in sight. The insects don't know how to bite, and lizards are not afraid of me. Every 7 or 8 days when I'm camping, I screw a small stone mill onto Anton B's back step. In less than an hour, I have my flour for bread. A 25-kilogram sack of wheat berries costs less than 5 loaves of supermarket bread. Dip a finger into fresh flour and it smells as alive as a little animal. Is there anything more peaceful or satisfying than turning flour into dough? This simple alchemy of sea salt, water, and my own wild leaven. This dough forming like a head in my hands. My balcony brush, swish-swishing across the Tibetan rug, is a rhythmic link to all the early morning sweepers of Asia and Africa, and even as far away as 12th century Baghdad. In The Conference of the Birds, One of Furid ud-Din Atta's sweepers has just been given a bracelet sparkling with jewels from the king. Who did Anton B. save, I'm always wondering, when it was used as an ambulance? Until 2002, my emergency year, ambulances had always been like fire engines, an urgent wail for somebody else's disaster. Sorry, a man who used to drive ambulances in the 70s tells me in a caravan park laundry, but your old Ambo would usually have been heading for the morgue. Most people died. This, he claims, was mainly due to heart attacks happening most frequently around 11 p.m, the body unable to cope with its last heavy meal. Ambulances back then carried little more than oxygen and a first aid kit, splints in the cupboard where I now keep my rolled oats and almonds. Probably shouldn't tell you this, says the ex-driver, but one night we had a man who was smashed into smithereens, come off from the 33rd story of a building in George Street. He was only young, but we couldn't lift him. No bones big enough left.
Witcherware.
In the camp I choose for my first solo bush birthday, almost a year after setting forth, the air's alive with small birds.
Witch you, why you, they sing. Witch you, witch you.
Thinking back to turning 38 3 years ago, I try to cry but can't. The air of this clearing is too limpid, the noises from the small circle of a wetland too strong for tears.
Why you, witch you,
cry the black-faced flycatchers, sallying in the air after insects. So here at last, just before I turn 41, will be the place safe enough to fully remember. The urgent need for this makes me grind flour fast for my next loaf of bread. In less than half an hour, I'm done. I check the leaven. Good. It's very active, its bubbles rising and popping. In haste, I form the dough. Flouring its bottom and setting it in the sun to rise, it will take all of the bright day. At last I'm ready to allow the past to roll out like the present. Like the Romans, I believe memories are stored in your core, in your heart of hearts. So in a sunny glade, lying on a blanket, I place my hands there over the vertical scar to help let it be 2002 again. In the few days lead up to surgery, my sister nips open the restricted red patient file and at my behest reads, severely wasted, unwell lady, febrile, septic, with severe mitral regurgitation and acute heart failure, limited movement due to extreme pain everywhere. From my hospital bed, I weep at the sheer implausibility of how something as shining as macro-errantry has led me down a path this dark. When I dare a glimpse in the hospital bathroom mirror, I think that if I were a wounded wallaby by the side of the road, I'd knock the life out of her with my car jack. When I'm weighed in a basket, I'm 39 kilos. Naked, I look like a concentration camp victim. My liver shutting down has lent my skin a dreadful snakeskin yellow hue. I feel stranded in a script penned by a horror writer devoid of skill. That it's my drastic love affair that has brought me to this point is part of my pain. After trying so hard, and my sobbing holds all the folly of my submersion into macrobiotics. So no, I decide in front of the hospital mirror, I won't look any more into my own night of the sad countenance face. I will avoid the appearance of my thighs, fallen like two twigs underneath the hospital gown. I won't dwell on the ash my lover used to treat the bedsore that smells of death, there at the base of my spine, nor on his absence from this bedside of extremity he so helped to create. Instead, I tune into the sheer pageantry of life. The whole hospital's a show on which I feast and feast, unable to take my fill. Look, there go Dr. Miriam Welgampola's shoes again, so small, so elegant that surely elven cobblers create each new pair in the night. What is the exact tragedy of the chain-smoking Kurdish Iraqi doctor with the smouldering good looks? How come his eye got blackened at the Coogee Bay Hotel? And the friendly tableau of night nurses munching on the lollies that fuel them through their shift. Such scenes are a call to life more potent than any painkiller. Here come processions of precious friends carrying baskets full of the most marvellous food and drink. After 2 years wherein the eating of sugar was equated with shooting up heroin, I tune in to home-baked puddings and ice cream. Human flirtation comes next to my bedside. Oh, the lovely flitterings of it over me as I lie inert, surrounded by beloved members of my family. My dark-haired sister, the beauty of her dressed like an 18th-century gypsy, as her deep brown eyes meet the nearly black ones of the bodybuilding male nurse from the Philippines. My father, too, laughing with happiness, as he recognises he is indeed still attractive to the nurses. Ah, the light-hearted eddies across my shriven form, so that in the absence of fresh air, this is an almost greater tonic. Finally, there's Dr. Grant, the cardiothoracic surgeon himself. Of all the doctors, he's my favourite, declares my sister. Thank goodness he'll be performing your operation. Have you noticed his energy? He's like a bull. Matador, I secretly think, with his elegant moustache, especially when he goes by wearing a surgical gown as dramatic as any cape. When one of the students confides that as a surgeon, Dr. Grant is renowned for his surgery on the hearts of children, I make a point of looking at his hands. His fingers are a poet's, long and pale. Due to my emaciated condition, the risks of open heart surgery are high. Before I sign the permission form, I must be aware that I might die. But without this surgery, then my death is certain. When the day of the operation arrives, my grief in saying goodbye to my colourful retinue is greater than all the towering floors of the ugly hospital. The ward's grey dullness runs in time in me with Psalm 55. My heart is sore pained within me, and the terrors of death are fallen upon me. Fearfulness and trembling are come upon me, and horror hath overwhelmed me. Regret flows in me. So this could be the last landscape of my life, this desolate place full of suffering people. According to the Socratic aphorism, I can't be judged to have excelled at philosophy because I haven't practiced for my death, for my dying, not at all. I'd always taken it as given that in the style of St. Francis of Assisi, I would die outside, on solid ground, on grass, far into the future when I was old.
Listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.